So today's topic is...
Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Tim. Today's topic is money. What are your two cents?
No, you go ahead. I wish all of you could see where we are. Can you describe it? What are you sitting right in front of?
We're sitting in the middle of our CNC machine shop in Bay 1 in the center of our machining cell. So we've got a whole bunch of vertical CNC mills and CNC lathe and other stuff around us. We just put a rolling table out in the middle of the room and dropped power to it. And it is, it's where I do my work.
And to say that it is neat is, it doesn't begin to touch it. I suppose a lot of machine shops are neat, but there are none that are as organized and neat as this.
There are some, and I look up to them.
Seriously?
But, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There are some.
Do they have any employees?
They do. They do. One of the things that I've seen some really high-end precision shops do is like white epoxy floors. Like there are some machine shops that are practically lab grade because of the kind of work they do. If you're doing really, really tight tolerance, very, very small precision parts, you have to have temperature and humidity control for the entire space, isolated separate floor slabs for the machine so they're vibration dampened. You can get into some really, really cool stuff. But
for shops in
our kind of industry, working generally on relatively unregulated stuff, yeah, I think we run a pretty tidy ship. So on the topic of money, money in marriage, money as it relates to church membership, encountering issues around money, coming into pastoral ministry and leading a church, money as it impacts a board of elders, money as a resource that has an impact on decisions about which ministries the church engages in and how money related to growth, building campaigns, expansion, compensation of staff, who you hire and when for how much. Money intersects with all kinds of decisions, and a lot of them aren't strictly black and white. They're questions of wisdom and timing and opportunity and tolerance for risk. So then let's start by talking about money in the home, money in marriage, thinking about career, moving your family for a job, all the various things that money influences, and then we can probably come to a good stopping point and then have our next episode pick up on money in the church.
Okay.
So, in your experience, husbands and wives are always equally matched in their attitude, their approach, and their background with money. They have identical attitudes toward it. They have identical skill in saving it and spending it, and so it's a source of unity and synchronization in every marriage.
Well, no. Now, as you talked a couple of episodes ago about going into Sam's and splurging on a bunch of olives and anchovies or sardines or whatever it was. Now, generally, a husband and wife aren't at the same point. But I remember going over to visit a friend of mine in our church, and he was in leadership. And I got over to his house, and his wife was gone. I think she'd been out of town for a week or so. And this guy's normally unflappable. But this particular day, he was not happy.
He was flapped.
Yeah, he was flapped. And I didn't have to probe, but he just started talking about the fact that his wife had put him $50,000 in debt with her credit cards.
Whoa.
And that he was just not pleased. And he's a man who really loves people. So it's not that this guy finds fault and, you know, he's not that kind of guy. And I realized how common it is for us to, as husbands and wives, to have to find a way of living with the sins of our partners, of our wife, of our husbands. This is equally true for wives with their husbands.
Yeah.
Almost always we're very different.
It shows up in a lot of surprising ways. My family, I have 7 siblings, and my dad always worked hard, was well-employed, but was chronically underpaid. And I think the reason he was chronically underpaid was because he is not a complainer, and he's fairly averse to risk. And so the uncertainty, the risk of leaving a company to go get a better job offer elsewhere, was very daunting. And so the company he worked for could continue to underpay him for a long time, and it would never really get to push comes to shove, I'm putting in my notice and I'm going someplace else. Mm-hmm. And I've told him a number of times, he actually retired this past year, but I told him a number of times, Dad, you should be making approximately double your current salary. Mm-hmm. You provide so much value to this company. You have saved them so many millions of dollars over the years through your careful management and stewardship of their projects. You should be getting paid a lot more. Mm-hmm. But in my family growing up, like, we didn't go out to eat often. And there are certain things that stand in my mind as a type of how our family approached restaurants and things. And you'll find these very distinctive characteristic things that are minor, but they're very, very salient. Like, we would never buy soft drinks at McDonald's. Mm-hmm. We almost never bought French fries. If we were going out, we were always, the whole family was getting stuff off the dollar menu. That was just what we did. Our family, for us, functionally, combo meals didn't exist. There was no point asking mom, hey, mom, could I get a number 6 combo meal with large fries? It was just, it wasn't something you asked. And we didn't go to the movie theater often, occasionally, but we would never buy popcorn at the movie theater. We would never buy snacks at the amusement park. We would go every spring, we'd go to a theme park in our area with a bunch of other homeschool families, and we'd always go a little bit before peak season. So it wasn't crowded. There was plenty of parking, and school trips weren't going to the park yet. So it was always cold when we went. And my mom would always pack a cooler full of peanut butter sandwiches and juice packs and things. We would never buy lunch at the theme park. When I went to high school, I bagged my lunch every day. I almost never bought anything from the cafeteria. It was just, that was our family's approach to things. And for my wife, they went to the movie theater more frequently, not a lot, but it was like a core part of their family experience that they would always get one giant bucket of popcorn and pass it around the entire movie. And so we took our kid to a movie recently. My wife was getting ready to buy a giant bucket of popcorn. I'm like, what are you doing? Why would you do that? We don't buy popcorn. We're not a buying popcorn at the movie kind of family. And she's like, what are you talking about? And that the amount of dollars there is not consequential, but it is a snapshot of a whole attitude toward money, where husbands and wives often come in preloaded with tons of experience, watching their parents manage money, watching their parents fight about money, watching there be either, you know, boom and bust cycles, plenty and want in their home, understanding how their family shopped for groceries, what they did for vacations, if they did vacations, when they went on road trips, what they ate and how they did road trips. Did they stay in nice hotels, or did they pack a tent and camp? All these different things, we don't tend to examine them when we're kids because it's just the life we live. And then we get to be adults and we're choosing how we're going to spend our own money that we're earning. And there's a lot of baggage there. I know I have a lot of baggage around money. And it isn't because I think my parents were unfaithful. I think my parents were faithful. But there's a lot of assumptions built into how I think about money that I'm having to unlearn. You commented that you were glad that I wasn't ever in your church rich. Mm-hmm. And certainly as our business has grown and we've hired more people, I've been able to pay myself more. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to do more to support ministries in the church. But at a certain point, my wife and I had a conversation where we just looked at each other and said, are we these kind of people now? Are we the kind of people who have money to spend on things? And that's been one of the most noticeable issues we've had to work through, is just, if we have more resources to steward, how do we steward them?
Well, first of all, you are rich. I saw you wince when I said that.
Yes, I did.
You are very wealthy right now, not in the future, right now.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that I'm firm in saying that to you is that people in your position often adopt a posture and an attitude and a way of talking that it doesn't resemble reality. I had a man in the church for many, many years who would talk about how much more I earned than he earned. And this man was worth millions. But this man had come to the point where he had sold his business and was living off of the profit. And I had another man in seminary that I worked for who every day when he would get in his little sort of station wagon Ford, he'd never take his huge Mercedes, 550 or 580 or whatever it was, huge. He'd say to me, Tim, you know, I have to earn a dollar to pay you a dollar. You know, I'm 50% tax bracket, you know, or whatever it is. And I would always say to Mr. Spaulding, it takes you about 30 seconds to earn a dollar or 5 seconds or 1 second.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in other words, people who have significant wealth have many ways of lying to themselves. One of the most common is that men who have businesses do not acknowledge the capital accruing because they own the business year after year and improve it. And that's what I would say to that gentleman in our church. I'd say, look, you know, you spent years not taking a salary, but building a business. Then you sold the business. What, you want me to be blind to the fact that you built a business and sold it for millions of dollars? You know, it's crazy. I dealt with this with another man in our church. He and his wife married in our church, and then he decided to go to medical school. And a couple of years after he started medical school, he put out an email to the whole church saying, listen, my wife and I are poor, and we don't have much money. Do any of you know a good – I think he was trying to buy a Camry. Any of you know a good Camry that we could get cheap? And I went to him, and I said – dear brother, I was very close to him. I said, dear brother, don't ever call yourself poor. Everybody in the church knows that in a couple of years, you're going to be pulling in loads of money. And so the fact that you don't have that money now is really insignificant. You should not be copying a posture as a poor man when there are people in this church who really are poor.
Yep.
And so I think we have to realize as Americans, we're filthy rich.
Yeah.
We're filthy rich. My brother told me that he, as of today, is 65, and he went and saw a doctor. He hadn't been there for 6 or 8 years because now it's free. And he got a treatment that he's been waiting years to get. All right. So that's the first thing I want to say. And as far as what our habits are, I think we put a disproportionate emphasis on the questions of movies, of junk food, of pop, of beer, of because, again, what really makes you wealthy is your ability to give money away. Now, let me back up for a second and say this. When Dad died, he had a car that had a license plate that said Tyndale. And it was a very old and beaten Buick, okay? Every Christmas, Mom would give all of us gifts from her resale shop that she worked at as a volunteer. A couple of times she splurged. When Dad died, she did a little work in the home of changing carpets and putting in paint, you know, painting. And but I mean, they never ever spent money except money that they spent to help other people. Okay. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, I used to talk about how people like that are devoid of any motivation or any pride with respect to giving money away. But then my brother corrected me one time. The ability of giving money away is itself wealth, because it wins you friends and influences people.
Yes.
It gives you power and authority. It gives you gratitude. And so be very careful about that, because if you're not, then what you'll do is you'll not be on guard against the deceitfulness of wealth. You'll think, well, I'm giving it all away. I'm not wealthy. I'm giving it away. Well, the ability to give it away is wealthiness.
Yeah.
And be careful about it, because one of the things my wife and I have seen through our years is that wealth has corrupted a countless number of Christians that we have known. At this point in my life, I've gotten to the point where I actually think, and I just have cautioned men who are training for the ministry, don't ever get wealthy. And I would prefer that they not get doctorates for the same reason, because doctorate is one of, you know, the biggest sources of wealth in the Western world. It gives you an immediate respect, an immediate power, authority. We have to be very careful how we think about wealth. Any American has it. Whether they're poor or rich, any American is wealthy. Whether they're black and white, or whether they're educated or not educated, America is unbelievably wealthy. So is all of Europe. So if we start saying all of us are wealthy.
Yes.
The poor are wealthy. You know, we lived in a low-income housing project where we were about the only whites when we first got married for a few years. And our friends who lived across the way, they'd often babysit. They'd spend the whole weekend playing poker. Okay. And they would have their thermostat up over 80 degrees. They'd have a huge television. And that's how they spent their money. I once counted the hands. And they would play poker from at the end of the working day on Friday till Sunday afternoon. I don't know if they ever went to bed. It didn't seem to matter what time I went over there at night. They were still up playing poker and smoking and drinking and 80, 85 degrees. And I counted, and there were $45 in each hand. Now, these are people that live in subsidized housing. That's a certain kind of wealth that you can spend the whole weekend playing poker, having $40, $45 per hand,
yeah,
having 80 to 85 degree temperatures in Wisconsin, having a large screen TV, and never stopping smoking and drinking. A lot of people in the world would give their right arm to be able to live like that. Here in America, that's called poverty. Now, having said that, we do have habits that discipline us. And I don't know what to call that discipline. It has to do with junk food. It has to do with soda pop. It has to do with making versus buying. And those disciplines are legitimate. You learned them as a child.
I did.
And I would say my wife and I both came from the same thing. I mean, it was unheard of that we would go out to eat. Unheard of. Neither of us had television, so of course we didn't even go to movies. We never had soda pop, ever, ever, ever. We read, the applesauce was the rotten, wormy apples that fell off the tree right outside of the kitchen window at mom's house, and she just ground them up, and that was our applesauce.
Extra protein?
Yeah, extra protein. But on the other hand, they did buy a couple of, they bought one summer place on Lake Michigan down in Sawyer, Michigan, and just down from Bethany Beach, if anybody knows where Bethany Beach is, down at the end of that road. And they made that house a gift to their 10 children. And we have gathered there a week and a half, the whole time they've owned it. So now this is a habit that is 40.
This is what you guys refer to as
43 years.
Michigan House.
The Michigan House. And then we tore down the cottage. It had a cottage on the property and built a house there. And then we bought the next house over. So this is all now owned by a trust. But mom and dad have been so careful in not giving money to their children. And it's always been such a delight to me when I see the corruption of evangelicals by wealth, that mom and dad and my parents, they all had the sense to not give their money to their children. Now, I don't mean that we didn't inherit money, but if you knew what the amounts were, I tell people when they come in our home, this home is because we took care of my aunt, who was single her whole life. She was the chief secretary on the World Trade Center building it between Tishman Construction and the Port Authority. And we took her in for the last 6 or 7 years of her life. And when she died, it turns out she never spent any money. And so she divvied the money up between my mother, my sister, my brother, me, and my other brother, his descendants. So if you think about that being the most significant money we inherited, mm-hmm. you realize what we didn't inherit from my parents and from Mary Lee's parents.
Yep.
But they gave us this house, and they also paid half of the expenses of all their grandchildren's college. So that took away my midlife crisis. I didn't know about it until Heather was ready to go to college, and then they announced it. Okay.
Interesting.
Yeah. And it really did take away my midlife crisis. I had no idea how I was going to be able to afford her going to college. And so there are a few things like that that they did. But interestingly, when those homes, when my son Taylor, who you know, when he dies, all those homes will be sold and the money will be given to nonprofits. And so nobody has any financial benefit from those homes other than that's a place we're able to go and have family reunions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I wanted to say that as a way of making it clear that I don't believe in parents who are wealthy giving their money to the children. Okay.
Okay.
I just do not believe in it. Now, I do believe that we should leave money to our children and grandchildren. But and I've watched, and I'm not going to get into the details because you'd be able to guess who it is, but I've watched and I have warned wealthy men, don't give your money to your children. And I know I'm blowing in the wind. They're going to do it. And it will completely corrupt their children. Well, there's occasionally a child that it won't corrupt. Let me give you an illustration, which you've probably heard. My father was one of the people that started InterVarsity. InterVarsity's had an unusual thing because always they have been the ones, although I'm sure they don't do this anymore, but they always had fundraisers that raised the money for their staff. Staff didn't have to go out and deputize, didn't have to raise their own support. Well, Dad knew the chief development guy at InterVarsity, and he had gone to a man who was the scion of a wool merchant in New England, very wealthy. So we're talking about old money. And that man had given a lot of money to InterVarsity in its first couple of decades. Well, then that man got old and he was getting ready to die. And this development man that went to him and said to him, what are you going to do with your money when you die? And the man said, well, I'm going to leave it for my children. And he said, who gave you that money? And the man looked at him and said, God did. And the development guy said, so God gave you the money, but you're going to give it to your children when you die. Why are you going to do that? And the man said, well, because they'd hate me if I didn't leave them my money. Now, that's a story in itself. But mm-hmm. the part of the story I love is that my father would then say he never went back to that man for any money. That was Dad's point. You don't take money from people like that. You don't do it. Then my dad said that he knew the children of that man after he died. I think there were three. I think one of them maybe stayed a Christian, and the other two were just wastrels.
Hmm.
And I've never forgotten Dad telling that story because I think we have to realize that wealth is deceitful. Deceitful. You and I both know people in our church who have been deceived by their wealth. You know them.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have known people who have not been deceived by their wealth. I just wanted to start by sort of leveling the playing field, telling everybody that thinks they're poor, you're not poor. You may have relative deprivation. You want to explain that?
Well, just If you measure yourself against the people around you, you may be below average in your immediate circles, but that doesn't mean poor in an absolute sense, and it can blunt your perspective.
Yeah, yeah. Now, given that, how is wealth deceitful?
Unpack that a bit. So I've had to think a lot more about money in the past few years as I've had to choose how to spend a lot more of it as the business has grown. And I remember reading a short quote from a guy named Tim Ferriss, a businessman, and he said, if you have a problem, but you have the money to solve the problem, you don't have that problem. And I remember chuckling at that and thinking, well, that's kind of obviously dumb. That's like John Madden saying, well, if you want to win the football game, you know, you got to put some points on the board. And if you put up more points than the other team, you know, you win the game. It's like, yes, that's the point. But it was a very interesting realization for me that a lot of the problems and decisions that I can worry about and spin my wheels about for a long time often can simply boil down to, do you have the money to fix this problem? If so, feel free to spend the money, fix the problem, and move on. Wealth can be both, it can create overconfidence. You can think, well, I can solve any problem. I've got money. And you can't. It doesn't take 10 seconds for a problem to crop up that you can't solve with money. You can't solve, you can modify relationships with money. You know, there's always going to be a chemical reaction when you add money to a relationship. But you can't fix a relationship with money. You can't buy genuine friendship or love. But on the other side, it's often easy to underestimate what you can accomplish. Jesus said in Luke 16, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. And there's a, I think that a faithful biblical approach to money will at times scandalize church people because of its apparent profligacy, but will also sometimes scandalize church people because of your absolute unwillingness to spend money on certain things. And if you never come close to being, to appearing to be in either of those ditches, then you might not be using it well. Does that make sense? I want to bring up Jesus' words in Luke 16, where he said, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. And the idea that it isn't something that Christians can't use and shouldn't touch. It's not verboten for us to use it. And sometimes we should seem to be generous to the point of profligacy. When the woman broke the vessel of oil of nard and poured it on Jesus' feet, and Judas was incensed, we know not for honest motives, but because he liked to pinch money from the purse. He was
which
saying,
is what the text of Scripture
yes,
says.
Yes, Scripture clearly informs us that Judas' motivation for...
He objected to her using a year's wages of perfume.
Yep.
To love Jesus and prepare him for burial.
But Jesus did not say, yeah, that was a bit over the top. She probably shouldn't have done that, but the cat's out of the bag now. She's cracked the vessel and, you know, we can't go back, so continue. He just said, this will be told about this woman throughout history. This story will be known. She's cared for me. There is a sense in which Christians ought to be willing to be extravagant with money. Christianity is not about tightness as a virtue. Stewardship is important, and managing your money wisely, not being the prodigal son, taking your inheritance, running off and ending up completely broke and destitute, but we should be willing to use it and use it aggressively.
Yeah, I remember hearing a man out in Boulder teach on that parable, Gene Wolfe, and the application he made to it has stuck with me. And by the way, preaching... Don't ever look at preaching as something you do on a stage. Good sermons are sermons that you walk away humbled and more helpful than you walked in. They never, ever, ever call attention to the preacher. Never. And so here Gene Wolfe gave this, you know, sermon teaching on that particular parable. And, you know, about the steward that halves the debts of mm-hmm. all of his owner's debtees or whatever. I remember he applied it to the issue of tipping. He said at the time that the waitresses he knew said that church people on Sundays left the lowest tips of anybody. I'll bet that waiters and waitresses would say the same today.
And probably.
That is a scandal to the name of Jesus. We should be those who are most solicitous for the good of the maids, of the waiters and waitresses, of the car mechanics, of the landscapers, of the trashmen, of the mailmen. We should not be saving money at the expense of the people who are beneath us. And I don't mean beneath us in value. I mean beneath us in the socioeconomic scale. So the first thing I would say is that we should be extravagant to the people who serve us. Not make a show of it at all.
Yep.
As a matter of fact, hide it. But we also have to be very careful about making a show of our giving. It is so common and it is so repulsive. I remember Sunday evening once after an evening service, I remember a man coming up to me and he was just very, very intense and saying, Tim, I need to talk to you. I need to talk to you. And so he ended up talking to me in a room where people were walking through and handed me a check for $100,000. And my wife and I want to give this to the church and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And can you imagine how I felt?
Icky?
I just felt icky. I mean, on the one hand, if I were to describe the circumstances of the church's relationship to that man at that time, oh my. And it was just, if a gift of $100,000 can be cloying and leave you feeling like you went into the cotton candy machine and came out, mm-hmm. that's what I felt like. Furthermore, I don't ever, ever want to receive money from anybody for the church.
Don't want to receive. You don't want to be the person that handles the
transaction. I don't want to know what they do. I don't want to know what they give. Doesn't mean that I can take an educated guess every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want people to relate to me as a proprietor, that they're trying to assure me that they'll make sure that the church, the business I run, is profitable, which is exactly what's going down in a situation like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it just shouldn't be. Now, we'll get back to the church.
Yeah.
But you're talking about generosity. When it comes to knowing how much somebody gives,
I remember you saying to me that when you consider men for church office.
Yeah.
So we'll come to that.
Yeah, we'll come to that because that's the other side of it. You need to know that your deacons and elders and that your pastors are at least tithing. And I don't care how poor they are, because you don't want people in leadership who are greedy. And any man in America today who doesn't tithe is a greedy man. Now, I don't mean that tithe is the limit, but I don't watch the money. Okay.
Yep. I actually feel the same way in my business. I'm in the process of getting myself out of the accounts payable and accounts receivable part. First of all, because there's no reason I should be the one doing that work. Mm-hmm. I don't need to be the one paying the bills. I don't need to be the one scheduling the bank transfers and making sure our mortgage payment goes. Like, we can use automation for a lot of it, but there's no reason for me to be the one doing it. And
it can influence your feelings.
I've told my staff every quarter when we have to do our estimated tax payments, I said, I'm going to walk around the shop with a little black cloud over my head for a day or two because it always feels so bad to have to cut a big check to the government because they're so, it's just, I look at that money and think, I could hire somebody with this money and I could do something else good with this money. And instead I just have to send it off.
It off to the Ukraine.
I just joke that I'm going to send it off to Washington and they're going to shovel it in a ditch and light it on fire. Like, they're not even going to heat their home with it. They're just going to put it in a pit and burn it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I commented to my wife several years ago, the first year that we started showing enough profits early enough in the year that we had to start making significant quarterly estimated tax payments as a business. I came home one day and I said, nobody warned me how bad this was going to feel. Because, you know, when we were first married and I was starting the company, we were breaking even, dead even every year. We were paying ourselves. But at the end of the year, if we had $5,000 in the company accounts, we were doing great. Like, taxes at the end of the year were paid, payroll was made, and we were just starting again every year. And we spent a couple of years living in subsidized housing, and we didn't have any savings. We were working on building a little emergency fund for car expenses, all the basic stuff that people do. And I'd never had to emotionally grapple with how it felt to pay a large tax bill. And I was not prepared. And so I've said this, I've said that to other business owners that I know who are a little bit younger than me in their business life. If they haven't hit that point yet, hey, buddy, at a certain point, you're going to start cutting larger checks to the government. And you need to prepare for that because it's going to feel bad. It's going to awaken something in you you didn't know was there. You're going to feel a kind of resentment that you didn't think you would feel, with an intensity that surprises you. But in the home, we talked earlier about husbands and wives normally being mismatched in their experience with money, in their attitude toward money. Usually one is freer with spending, is more comfortable looking at unfunded future liabilities and not worrying about them. If a family is looking at buying a home, how much home can they afford? If they're looking at changing, you know, the husband or wife works, they're looking at changing their job or changing their career. All the fear and uncertainty about money, will we be able to pay for this, pay for that, send our kids to the school we want? All those different things. There's almost always a difference between a husband and wife about those. And there's no magic answer, but what are some things you've observed and what would you say?
Well, when my children were growing up, I remember saying to Taylor, our youngest, that if he is going to be godly and give the gift of motherhood to his wife, instead of double dipping with her, having her trained as a nurse and she can work a couple days a week and this, that, and the other thing, that he was going to have to earn at least $55,000 a year. Well, he didn't want to go to college. And so I said to him, you know, if you don't go to college, you're going to have to work harder to earn $55,000 a year.
Yep.
But I think I was wrong about that, because if you look at the statistics about what rural people earn without going to college, it's actually pretty good. So then I started saying to him, if you want to be the one that sets the standards in your organization, you're going to have a harder time being able to be the boss if you haven't been to college. So that's where we've ended up on that one. But I do think as Christians, we always need to be thinking biblically and spiritually with the eyes of faith about money issues. And college is a huge money issue. Running a business is a money issue. Who you marry is a money issue. How many children you have is a money issue. What education is a money issue. All these things are money issues.
What kind of cars you drive?
Yeah, what kind of cars you drive, how you heat. Where you go on vacation, clothing, food, whether you go out to eat, all these things are money issues. How long your mortgage is? Do you take out a 15, a 10, a 20, or a 30? When do you refinance? These are all money issues. What do you give to the church? What do you give to a capital campaign? Even though I'm a pastor, all my thoughts about money don't have to do with the church. So, for instance, when we first got married, we did not have chairs. We did not have any sofa or easy chairs or a table. We did not have a bedstead. We had just a mattress. We had a chest of drawers, and we sat cross-legged on the shag carpet. That's how we ate. We had no phone. And so if people wanted to see us, they had to drive down South Park Street in Madison and see if we were home. And Mary Lee and I worked together. We worked painting houses, reglazing windows, cleaning carpet, cleaning upholstery, stripping and waxing floors, stuff like that, cutting grass. I had a large church that I was a custodian of, and then we had a bunch of jobs on the side. When we had our first baby, we had our baby at home, very cheap. And we lived in subsidized housing. And I just went back there a few weeks ago to look at it. And yeah, it's nothing like what you call subsidized housing, even though there is a subsidy for your housing.
Fair.
And we moved in there. And I want to say that our initial rent was $250 a month, if I remember, maybe $200. Well, then I got a steady income by going to work for this church in addition to everything else. So it was salary. And I didn't want to tell the people that ran our subsidized housing that I'd gotten a raise. And I fought over that. And I just knew that I had to do it. So I went in the office and told them. And they, I remember very clearly feeling that I was falling on my sword for God, you know, if that's possible.
Yeah.
And as soon as I said it to them, they said, now, how many dependents do you have? And I said, three. And I remember the lady saying to me, well, then your rent won't go up because you have an additional dependent. There was no question in my mind that that was a direct gift from God to me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you are not a Christian and you don't live dependent on God, you won't understand what I just said. But God has many ways of giving good gifts to his children. And his way of giving me a good gift was giving me a child who then kept my pay or my rent from going up. And we've had so many things like that over the years where, you know, and it doesn't just work positively, it works negatively, where we'll get a gift of 50. I remember Mary Lee, one time we got an extra $50 from somewhere, and Mary Lee was just excited out of her mind.
Yep.
And then immediately she got a bill from her doctor for $50, and she was so angry, you know. And then she realized, well, that's why God gave her the 50. It wasn't just so that she could splurge. And although Mary Lee is incapable of splurging, trust me. So we're the opposite, you know. We're Mary Lee is her mother's daughter. She is as tight, except when it comes to other people. That's what's sweet.
Well, between my wife and I, the way we've managed our home finances, and this is, I don't think there is a biblical principle over whether the husband or the wife should be the one who manages the home finances. I think that's whatever works for each couple, depending on their gifts and skills. But in our home, our wife manages our home budget, budgeting for food, making sure that kids' tuition payments are made, you know, all the various things that relate to our home economy and its expenses. And then I'm responsible for the business and its finances, and we split the responsibility for our church giving, and we have certain regular recurring gifts to start our normal money we give all the time, and that's based on our budget, and we give that automatically. And then additional, any other gifts for particular events, for building campaigns, for that stuff, then I make those decisions about when we're going to give and how much. And there's a real value to both of us having some responsibility for that, but each of us not being the only one who does it, and being able to say, we're sharing that responsibility. But I'm certainly the one who's probably more free with money, but I'm simultaneously more sensitive about certain inconsequential small expenses that just stick in my craw.
Yeah, that's a weird pairing. Mary Lee and I also do the same thing. We had a woman confront me over this back at our former church, not yours, but the one before that, ECC. She came in and she was confronting me about the fact that my wife handled the checkbook. And she said that it was unbiblical because I was the head of the home and I had an obligation to do that. And I said to her, well, you know, Mary Lee and I talk about what we do with our money. And it's not as if I'm not making decisions, but I do not want the responsibility of having to pay all our bills. And so I've never carried a checkbook. So I agree. If you have served farmers, my first church was farm community. You know, there's a division of labor on any family farm, which almost always is the wife doing the paperwork for federal subsidies. She handles the money. And she also is the one that cuts the grass on a riding lawnmower. And the husband does most of the field work, although if he's in a bind, she'll come out and run a combine or a tractor or something like that, cut hay. I think we need to be very careful about being judgmental and rigid on who does what, when, where, why, and how, given manhood and womanhood.
Yeah.
It often runs in ways that it doesn't run for other people, and we are each other's. We're accountable for our own home. We're not accountable for other people's home and what we think our pastor's wife should do. Unless, of course, what you see is that the pastor's wife is insane in how she spends money. And that can be a scandal in a church. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But I want to get back to the issue of schooling for a second.
Okay.
Because I don't want to miss that issue.
Mm-hmm.
Other than a home, definitely the largest expense for any couple that believes that they should have children mm-hmm. and that they should live in love without trying to control how many children they have. The biggest expense is going to be both schooling of the children growing up through high school and also their education, whether or not they go to college, and if so, where. And what I would say is trust God. Don't have a fit about your children's schooling. Because again, Mary Lee and I have seen how God has provided through the years for our schooling. And it may be that you don't get to go to the hoity-toity classical Christian school. It mm-hmm. may be that your children have to go to a charter school like we have here, you know, that's under the Hillsdale aegis, and you know, it's not a Christian school, but it's also not a public school. It is public, but it's something in between. It may be that you need to go to, as your church has, a hybrid home ed school, church ed, where a couple days a week they go to church, they're accountable, their mother is accountable, you know, and then they're at home the other days of the week. Mary Lee and I helped start a couple of Christian schools. God provided for us. Mm-hmm. And so I want to say to parents, do not make decisions based upon the education of your children as to how many children you have. That is faithlessness. I have a friend who, he and his wife say, you should only have as many children as you can educate well. And I think that that is faithless. God is the one that promises to provide for us and our children. And if we get to the point, I had an elder say to me once, I think of abortion as a question of stewardship. And, you know, people can get horrified at that and think, well, he's murdering. Well, yeah, but you're not having children and obeying God's command to be fruitful and multiply because you have a better notion of how many children you should have than God does. Doesn't God put life in the womb? And so I really want to fence off in this discussion any seeming agreement on my part with people who make decisions about how many children to have based on finances.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it is faithless. God has commanded us to make love fruitfully. And a command isn't weighed in light of what our car payments are and which schools there are in a community. And so God will provide, and I'm here to testify that God will provide. I think of you and your wife and the years where you didn't have nothing. And what do you think? Do you think that you're just naturally superior and so you managed to have the gifts? I remember Jonathan Edwards saying, he has a sermon on charity, on giving money away.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes through 7 or 8 or 9 reasons that we give for not giving money away. And I remember that it's like the 7th or 8th one is actually where he says, you say this. And then he responds, well, this one, he says, you say that the people who have, who are in poverty, are in poverty because they do not manage their money well. But is it not, in fact, that God has given you the gift of being able to manage your money well? And why should you be the only one who benefits from your ability to manage money well? Why shouldn't your brothers and sisters in Christ also benefit from that gift? And so education, especially up through high school, now let me talk about education in college. I have a little bit of a different take on it than most people. I have spent my life in university communities, Wheaton College. I know Covenant. I know Gordon College. My wife went to Westmont. I know Calvin. My daughter went to Taylor and son-in-law. And listen, be very careful about sending your children to an expensive college.
Okay.
In my experience, more often than not, the professors will corrupt your children. Often, children who are educated as they grow up in our homes and are taught to be discerning and who love God will do better on a secular campus than they will on a Christian campus. Now, I know this is probably blowing your mind and everybody's mind that I'm saying this. When people ask me where their kids should go to college, what I say is what my father always said. He went around speaking at all the Christian colleges as a Staley lecturer, and he spent as much of his life speaking to college students around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad said, the problem with a Christian school is that you don't know who the enemy is. He said, at a secular school, it's clear. Joseph aced the SAT completely.
Your son, Joseph.
Yeah. And he got to the point where he had to accept either Covenant College or Vanderbilt. And it came down to the night before he had to make his decision.
Mm-hmm.
He went out that night, drove around and talked to Michael, his younger sister, Michael Crum now. And he came back and said, I'm going to go to Vanderbilt. And I said, really, why? And he said, because I'm too trusting. And if I go to Covenant, I'll trust the professors there. But I won't trust anybody at Vandy. And you know something? I know people who are going to Covenant. I know professors at Covenant. If you think you're going to go to Covenant College and you're going to get a Christian education, yeah, you'll get a Christian education precisely as you'll get it at Wheaton, which means you'll be inoculated against the authority of Scripture. Now, I know you're upset by me saying this.
I'm not upset by it at all.
Okay. It's just true. Mm-hmm. It's just true. And remember, this is a 70-year-old man who knows all these schools, who knows tons of professors and has spent his life in higher education. And I tell people that if you're going to send your kids to grad school at Indiana University, and if they've gone to Calvin College, or they've gone to Wheaton, they've gone to Taylor, they've gone to Westmont or Gordon, they've gone to Covenant, they've gone to... The truth is, none of them any longer believe in the authority of Scripture. They all say they do. In fact, many of them will say, well, I think inerrancy is right. But when you probe them on any issue of our day, homosexuality, abortion, birth control, male and female authority and submission, their professors have inoculated them against the authority of Scripture. In other words, they have had men and women who claim to submit to the infallibility and often the inerrancy of Scripture, mm-hmm. teach them how to get around everything in Scripture they don't like. And I would much rather receive in our church a Roman Catholic.
Okay.
Because if you convince a Roman Catholic that Scripture has absolute authority above the church, they already believe they're sinners. Whereas evangelical colleges, everybody that goes to them thinks they don't have any sin. They had it, but then they were saved, and now they live with a gentle and lowly Jesus in Graceland. Now, I'm saying this not as a theological statement about the professors and the mm-hmm. boards of trustees of these schools. I'm saying this because I don't want parents to make decisions about their children and where they go to college on the basis of thinking that they've got to send them Grove City or Wheaton or one of these schools. The most important thing for you to do with your children is for you to find a church that's good, that's near a university. And I would prefer that our Christian kids go to a secular university. Now, of course, I would prefer Purdue over IU. Now, would you like to explain that to the listeners?
Well, there's a longstanding rivalry between Purdue and IU, and Purdue is historically very strong in the hard sciences, STEM, mathematics, engineering, and Indiana University is much stronger in the humanities, arts, music, and Bobby Knight sports stuff.
And what does that do spiritually?
Well, there's a certain kind of objectivity about the world when you are in engineering and mathematics, and a certain flexibility about everything when you're in the arts and the humanities. So Indiana University and Purdue, Bloomington is known as being an extremely liberal city and is, because of its emphasis on the arts, also has a very high proportion of gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, et cetera, et cetera.
You go to an engineering school and the numbers have to add up. You know, there, like you said, there's a certain objectivity to
it. The rocket doesn't fly if the math is bad.
Yeah. You can't just say, well, I think 1 + 1 = 3, you know. Whereas in Bloomington, oh, yeah, that is your perfect right to say 1 + 1.
Thank you for sharing your perspective with us. Yeah.
So you got this huge music school, opera, but you also have the Kinsey Institute.
Yes.
And if you know any of your history, in the 50s, Kinsey blew morality to smithereens. And so in terms of your children's education, higher education, the most important thing is that they will have shepherds who will watch after their soul. But they need to fight. What is higher education if it doesn't teach you how to think independently? They need to read the sources, the primary sources. They need to argue. They need pagans and Muslims and atheists as friends. And if that threatens you, I kind of want to say, stop what you're doing and learn how to do it differently as a parent. Because I'm not saying that you should send your children to the Canaanites to be educated, or that you should send your children to the public schools to be witnesses. No, there are easy ways of answering that. Namely, not until higher education.
Okay.
Although some kids are prepared to go into the university when they're 10th, 11th grade. Joseph had about a year and a half completed at IU before he graduated from high school. But he was a different breed of cat. And this is one of the things that bothers me about the church, the Reformed Church today. It's like everybody should have the same education, and I can't stand that. The fact is, any pastor who knows the children of the church can tell you who are going to be the leaders growing up. And it used to be that we had freedom to peel the leaders off and to give them an education for them being pastors from a very young age. And you knew who was not going to be leaders. And it was no shame for them to get a vocational education. But today, America is absolutely fixated on every possible person that can going to college. What I actually believe is that higher education has much more to do with acculturation than it does with learning truth. Okay? And so I think that, I'm sorry to put it like this, I think liberals intrinsically know that the more years they get your children under their authority teaching them, the less there's going to be Christian faith and sanity in ideologies and judgments and laws. It's interesting that Dewey was a professor of one of my dad's friends who went out to New York to get their doctorate in. This friend was at a 90th birthday party for him. I want to say it was New York University. Forgetting what school it was. I think it was NYU. And so he was at this 90th birthday. And he said that the common discussion among all the grad students and faculty was their desire to get children out from under their parents so that they could wean them from the ignorance of parents. And of course, you know, that's how everybody sees religion today. Mm-hmm. It's ignorance. So yes, I'm completely in agreement with not putting our little children, and usually definitely through junior high, and I would say through high school, let's give them a Christian education. But then at some point, we need to have our children learn how to stand for Christ. And if you think you can send them to Wheaton or Covenant or any of these schools, maybe Hillsdale. We have a lot of kids at my former church who go to Hillsdale. And, you know, what am I going to say? Shouldn't go to Hillsdale? Everybody would have a cow. I always try to get my kids to go to Grove City, because at least at Grove City, you don't pay a lot of money for it.
So let's circle back to that. The question of who should go to college, the numbers have grown more and more and more, and the expectation is everybody who finishes high school should go to college. That I don't agree that college is going to become free. I just don't. Certainly, I think college has become a much poorer return on investment for most people, even than it was when I went to college. I came to Bloomington in 2002. I spent 5 years at IU, did undergrad and started graduate work, and then dropped out. As an out-of-state student, I had a substantially higher tuition burden than in-state residents did. And it wasn't even really on my radar, the idea that I've seen a number of people do since, of deciding where they want to go to school, if they want to come to IU, move here, take two gap years, get a job, settle down, establish in-state residency, and then go to IU for way cheaper. That never even occurred to me as an option, and I came out of 5 years of school with student loans that I spent a lot of time paying down. And going to an expensive school where you're going to come out with, you know, $60,000, $80,000 in debt after 4 years of undergrad, if you send your son or daughter to that school and someone else sends their son or daughter to that school and your two kids meet and decide to settle down and get married after college and they're starting off with $150,000 of combined debt and no established careers yet, you've encouraged them to put themselves in a position that's going to make it way harder to be faithful with money.
We had one couple together, the two of them had $450,000 in debt when they finished at IU.
Yikes.
$450,000. Universities and colleges will take your money. I went and established residency in Wisconsin and waited. I think I only had to wait a year. And then I was accepted as a resident. And so that lowered it. I also believe in going to junior college or tech college, because you can get a lot of your requirements out of the way there dirt cheap.
Yeah, go to community college, get your general education courses done.
It's a great way of doing things, and it's humble. But again, I want to come back to this issue. You say, well, you come out with a lot of debt. I think the reason that a lot of parents don't have children and say no to God, no, I won't be fruitful and multiply, I'm just going to have a lifestyle option of one or two children, I think they do that because they feel that they owe a college education to their children. Mm-hmm. And you don't. You don't.
Yeah.
I have never seen there being better results and fruit in the life of young people whose parents paid their way through a snooty college than the fruit of those who worked for their college education. If you read what people write today and you think, what I always tell people is college education today is simply
remediation.
Remediation, yeah. That's what college today is. It's remediating the failure of the first 12 years.
Well, your point about building and maintaining a culture, I think, is interesting. This is the Ivy League and the entire existence of preppy culture and preppy fashion. And I actually heard a term recently that I remember seeing, but I'd never really understood what it meant, the term a Boston Brahmin. Are you familiar?
Yeah.
And this hilarious little ditty by John Collins Bossidy. And this is good old Boston, the home of the bean and the cod, where the Lowells talk only to Cabots and the Cabots talk only to God. And this very upper crust this came up. I was in a bookstore. I spent a couple days in Cincinnati last week with my wife celebrating our 15th wedding anniversary. So we got a hotel and went out of town. Our in-laws very generously watched our kids for us. And we sort of randomly blundered onto a bookshop that was four stories, used books, downtown Cincinnati. Awesome bookshop. We had planned to do a bunch of different things that afternoon. We went to the bookshop right after lunch, and we stayed until they closed, and then ended up out on the street with, I had a full box of books, and my wife had a bag of books. They made to walk back to our hotel. Mm-hmm. But I found a book by one of my favorite poets, Robert Lowell, and he was of the, you know, the Boston Lowell family. And it just had never, I've never spent time around old money. And the extent to which those schools, in particular, the Ivy League schools, have always been where you send your kids to make sure that they are fully equipped to fit into the crust of society to which they belong. That just was never even on my radar when I was
looking. Well, that's Wheaton.
Yeah.
That's Calvin. I mean, you know, we do the same thing. It's just different schools.
Yeah. But it's not a good investment for most people.
Oh, I'm not against kids going to college, but we need to begin to understand that college, rightly done, and certainly graduate school, rightly done, is a level of training that in many cases should be for leaders. And it's no fault for somebody to admit that God has not made them intellectually curious. We all want our children to be intellectually curious. You're one of the most intellectually curious people I've ever known in my life, Andrew. But can we please begin to see things biblically and allow ourselves to see things that other people deny they see? Isn't that really what it means to don't allow?
We're not allowed to see that.
Yeah. Is that what it means for us saying, don't let the world press you into its mold, which is the way J.B. Phillips paraphrased, be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And, you know, Harry Blumeyer's book, The Christian Mind, read it. Have your teenage son and daughter read it. Think about money. Think about education, because education is a huge part of the finances of any Christian home.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason I'm going on and on about education.
I wanted to pivot and talk about making money in the home. And I think it's important and right for young Christian men to be given a vision for starting and building businesses, generating wealth, creating new products, new services, and understanding that we have both a responsibility and an ability to build something that can carry more people than just us, than just our family, than just our wife and kids. And so I think it's good. I didn't really have much exposure to entrepreneurs and business owners as a young man. And so my thought of what a career would look like for me would be, I would get a job and the people who hired me would decide how much I got paid. And if I did good work, they'd gradually pay me more and more, but it would just be kind of an afterthought, like, well, I would do my work and I would get paid. And in our home, as we look at our budget and decide what to budget for, what to save for, what to spend on, I remind myself and I remind my wife, if we need more money, I have the ability to go out and make more money. I can go out and invent something or design something or come up with a new service and sell it. And that ability to say, I don't know where that money's going to come from yet, but we can figure it out and we can go make something happen. That can do, go get them attitude is something I want to see young Christian, especially young men, have more hands-on experience with. And it, you know, it's great to have a neighborhood lemonade stand, but there's a lot more to it than just teaching people, well, yeah, you can make up a whole bunch of cheap lemonade and get strangers in their kindness to pay you a dollar per glass for it.
Yes. And this again is something that you and I see similarly. I never had any trouble making money. I always made money. And sometimes I would get paid hourly. but almost always I would try to get people to pay me by the job so that I was motivated to get the job done well and quickly. As this world we live in becomes more pagan, Canaanite ideologically, it will be increasingly difficult for Christians to hold positions in public education, in law, in medicine, in a lot of the jobs that historically Christians have had leadership in. It is going to be a violation of ethics, and already is in many places, to simply have a fundamental, historically Christian commitment on a number of issues. Young parents must think about this in training their children. And this is a good reason to train your children to think entrepreneurially. Because if you are an entrepreneur, then you have a whole host of jobs where you can be the boss. And a lot of those jobs are going to be jobs that aren't taken away by AI.
Or HR. So
explain why you and I are saying HR.
Well, in a lot of larger corporations, but in a lot of schools, colleges, places that are HR focused bureaucracies, that's the leading edge of taking whatever political, social, cultural, sexual, ideological insanity and enforcing it. And
no appeal.
Yeah, well, it's not, you're not being accused of a crime. You're just being found in violation of a subjective policy.
Yeah, at least if you were accused of a crime, you could say your father raised you that way and you were, you know, you were oppressed growing up and this is just an extension.
You were exposed to heavy metals in the ground.
Yes.
So I want there to be more Christians being willing to take the risk to start companies and fail. I really don't think that it is... We don't have enough Christian small business owners yet. We don't need more people selling essential oils. We don't want MLM in the church. If you are a husband and you're struggling to make enough money to support your family, the appropriate response is not to get your wife to boss babe by selling cosmetics or Tupperware or, you know, leggings and cute halter tops to the other women in the church. I had a conversation briefly with a friend of mine, and she and her husband have moved, I think, 6 times in 7 years. He's in the military. He's been stationed in a number of places. They're young. They don't have any kids. And they've wanted to. They've been trying to, and they haven't been able to have any kids. But she commented that every time they moved to a new base and settled into new housing, wherever it was, that she always immediately ran into people who wanted to be her friend until at the second or third lunch, meeting her out for coffee or whatever, it turned out that they were just there to pitch her on joining their MLM scheme, whatever it was, selling this or that or the other thing. And that is horrifically corrosive. It destroys relationships. It destroys families. It destroys the church. Don't do MLMs. And they're all run by Mormons anyway. I don't know why that is, but tons of them.
Trading on the name of Jesus Christ and the Fellowship of Christ Church to make money. Okay? And so I agree with you completely about that.
The internet has made it possible to start home businesses in a way that was never possible before. So you can be industrious, thrifty, innovative, and faithful still, and find your customers everywhere, not have to find them in your church.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And we've had a number of men who have decided to make career changes. One guy that blew the horn, very, very good, came to get a graduate degree in it. And he threw it out. I don't even know, does he have it anymore? I'll bet he doesn't. Do you know?
I'm not sure.
So we always process instruments in our church. You know, well, did you sell it? Your bassoon? get $45,000 for it, you know.
For a lot of musicians coming to school like the Jacobs School, the instrument they come with is the single most valuable possession in the world. Yeah. I knew one girl in undergrad, her parents had refinanced their home to afford an instrument. And I talked to some other guy and he just made me sick. How did this go? I was in the violin making program. He came into our shop. He was a grad student to get some minor adjustment work done on his instrument. And he had a gorgeous, probably worth north of $750,000 instrument. And it was on loan to him from his aunt. It was her, she was a musician. She was also stinking wealthy. And she lent him this instrument for grad school. And he like would just hop on the city bus riding around. He's got his backpack and a $750,000 violin. And I did not have a $750,000 violin. I had the deal. One of the things my parents had done growing up was, if you start playing a string instrument young, you start on a fractional sized instrument, an eighth size or a quarter size, a half size. And as you get bigger, you size up. And generally, every time you size up, the kinds of student grade miniature instruments that are available to little kids don't sound good. They're hard to play. They're just kind of clunky. At a certain point, once you get to a full size violin, you can start to then invest in a good quality instrument. Fractional instruments are generally just student grade. What my parents did was, they confiscated all my money. If I got birthday money, it went in a savings account. If I got Christmas money, it went in a savings account. And every time I needed to size up to the next size violin, we would basically crack open my piggy bank and my parents would match dollar for dollar, however much money I'd saved, they'd match. And that was how much additional money I had to invest in the next instrument. And that was the way we did it even into college. They still like had a part-time job. I was saving up money. I needed a better instrument and they matched money with me. But the kinds of kids who were coming to school with a $40,000 or $50,000 violin that their parents had bought for them, it just boggled my mind. It was just not even on the radar.
Yeah, but it's very common that's the amount for
instruments. Easily.
And then if you're like Grace Halsey and some of the other people, one of them whom is today having her birthday, but her father is a doctor at Mayo. But anyhow, these people who play the harp not only have to have the instrument, but they have to have a minivan.
Yeah. Yeah. If you play the double bass, you're not driving a Prius C. You need a station wagon or a minivan.
Yeah. Now, go ahead.
You brought up particularly the horn in the context of, we've seen a lot of people come through music school as undergrad or grad students, and then they decide not to pursue a career.
Yeah, explain.
And they have to grapple with the, what do I do with this instrument?
Well, and they also have to grapple with what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And a number of them simply learn to program.
Yeah. That they did find something else to do. When Caitlin and I got married, we were both viola majors. We have two violas. And we basically said, we need money. We're going to keep one viola and sell one viola. Whose viola are we keeping? And what we ended up settling on was, her viola was worth more. And we both agreed that my viola sounded slightly better. And so we sold her viola, and that money like bought us a car. Mm-hmm. And that money saved our bacon in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But for musicians, if they've been sinking their life savings into an instrument for years and years and years and years and years, and then they pivot to a different career, letting go of that instrument is letting that previous life die. And it's not even about the money. It's about giving up that career.
Okay, so at this point, what's the name of that range? Read the book Range. Do not hesitate to give up your former life, your instrument, everything you've done up until now. Earlier, you were talking that people need to start businesses, right?
Yep.
One of the things you learn about starting businesses is it's extremely common for people who start businesses, before they become successful, to go through a bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. It's also common for a pastor at his second church to get run through the ringer. Failure is not bad.
And not always.
Well, some failures are disasters.
Yeah.
Although I would say my second church was a disaster.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of pain.
Yes.
But, oh, man, did I grow through it.
Yeah, and the stats on business ownership, most businesses fail in the first 5 years. The overwhelming majority of small businesses do not make it to 5 years. So the attrition rate is really, really high. And honestly, most people that start a business don't know what they're doing yet.
And so they learn.
And they learn painful, hard lessons. Mm-hmm. And the downside of being a business owner is if you get people with you, if you build a big enough organization that you have other families depending on you, you have a real obligation to learn fast. Because you can take everybody into the ditch with you. And that can be, I just saw this happen this past week with another business in another state where they just cracked up and laid everybody off very abruptly. Mm-hmm. And for all those families now, they are just kicking in the wind, trying to find a place to land. But it isn't the case that to start a small business and have it not succeed is a moral failing. Like, this person's not respectable because they didn't win at business. Listen,
failure is your friend. Failure is your friend. Mm-hmm. I keep trying to say this to young people, including young married couples. Don't have your goal in life to be not to fail.
Yeah.
It's a bad goal.
It is a bad goal.
Now, I want to talk about some things about the home before we bring this one to an end. I want to talk about a wedding. Mm-hmm. You do not have to spend $10,000, let alone $28,000 on a wedding. Mm-hmm. Don't do that. I have over the years seen that the best weddings are never the ones that are conspicuous consumption. Mm-hmm. And they never give issue to the best marriages. And so be humble with your wedding. And I'm not going to go into the details, but if you want to know the details, send me an email and I'll have my daughters tell you. Mm-hmm. Just establish an amount. If you happen to have been blessed by God with mostly girls and your daughters, get good at this, you know? And so weddings should not be expensive. Funerals. There are ways of having funerals that you don't have to spend much money at all. Don't cremate. I'm not going to go into the details on that, but don't think that you're being humble financially when you cremate. You're not. It costs a lot of money. What you want to do is figure out how to have a cheap funeral. Okay. Number three. When it comes to children, from a very young age, without being all rigid about it, teach them the value of money. Regularly say no to them. Don't allow them to buy candy when you're going through the checkout stand. Don't allow them to buy video games or just say no. You know, it's the responsibility of parents to say no to their children constantly. Mm-hmm. Because it teaches them what is and is not valuable. And you don't want them to grow up having a taste for video bling.
Yeah. I'm just right now changing how I manage some of my older two kids, older three kids sometimes come to the shop. Like my son Owen is here in the shop right now doing piecework. Mm-hmm. And I need to be careful. I've had to change how I track their time and pay them because I don't want to take advantage of them and just say, well, yeah, you're going to come to the shop and work for free because you're my kid and it's the family business. I do want them to understand that their work provides value, that I make money off it, and that they should get some of that in a clear and transparent way. But even there...
You know I'm getting uptight here.
Yeah. I don't pay my kids to do chores at home.
Yeah. Which is a completely different thing.
That doesn't mean there aren't bonus jobs. Like, I think our deal is the kids have various assigned chores, but... If a kid wants to give the family vehicle a thorough cleaning,
yes,
we'll pay for that.
Yeah, every parent, every father and mother will have different things that they decide that they will and won't pay for. Your children have an obligation. If you have an older daughter, she is obliged to help her mother with the younger children. Mm-hmm. If you have an older son, he is obliged to cut the grass, to trim the grass, and to do it as well as a professional would. Okay, in other words, the home should have equal contributions from the children. to its well-being, to setting the table, to cleaning up the dishes, to cutting the grass, to cleaning the car. And you want to pay them to clean the car, that's fine. As long as you don't develop a mentality in your children that if they work for the well-being of the home, they get paid.
Yep.
No, I don't believe in allowances. I don't believe in paying kids to do the work around the home. Although, when Owen comes here and works in the shop, and this is Saturday,
yep,
that's a different thing to me. Okay.
Yes, no question. Prenups.
No.
Okay.
Absolutely not. This is a common thing in marriage counseling where you will have a couple who break down their money with the man and woman. And I understand the whole bride price thing and that, you know, I was reading some history and they were talking about how every bit of money a woman earns before she becomes married is hers after she gets married. Well, I can see a reason for a woman having some independence financially from her husband when she gets married, because it does help to motivate her husband to treat her with respect. Okay.
Yep.
Having said that, a husband and wife should not have his and her money, his and her bank accounts. They should work hard to bring themselves united financially as they're united physically. And so when couples are jealous of each other and fight over how they spend money and they talk about his and hers, I always say to them, no, there's no his and hers in a marriage. You're together. The Lord has made you one. It's your home. It's your car. It's your money. It's your children. One of the things in counseling, and I can see that you're wanting to...
I'm listening along. I have some pushback, but it can
wait. Sure. That's okay. One of the things that maybe will help explain what I mean by this. If you're counseling a couple, one of the things that I notice very frequently is that a mother will refer to her children in a proprietary way, even in the presence of her husband. But even when he isn't there, she'll say, my children, or my daughter, or my son. And I'm telling you, if you do that, it's an indication of an absence of unity with your husband in the raising of your children and in the way you think about your life.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually an indication of a self-centered, pushy person who is proprietary in a way that excludes them using the, you know, we, our.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it comes to money, be very careful that when it comes to your children, it comes to your money, it comes to your home, don't say my. Don't do it. Now, that's where I'm coming from. Go ahead and
so my pushback on the shouldn't have his and hers money, I do think there is utility. One of the ways to
I agree.
One of the ways to manage the tension of the different approach to money of the two couples is to come to a neutral agreement about how money will be divided.
Yes.
And after a certain amount of money has been divided, there's no permission needed from the other person in terms of how you spend that.
Yeah.
That should be the functional details of how each family does that can vary. But there,
I agree.
There is utility to that.
One of the benefits of that is that whichever one tends to be more stingy or more responsible with money can just be philosophical, laissez-faire about the ways that their husband or wife, spouse spends money.
Yep. I mean, like, if the husband or wife has a hobby that they want to spend some money on, saying that's totally fine as long as you find a way to earn the extra money to cover that. That kind of sort of division of labor and division of spending. Like, my dad likes to hunt and he always is hunting. He's always looking out for, you know, a better wool shirt or more comfy gloves or other things. Mm-hmm. And that's it's his hobby. Mm-hmm. And he also plays music gigs on the side. And I think one of the deals my parents made was just that the money he makes from those occasional music gigs, she doesn't factor into her budget at all. And he's free to spend it on hunting stuff if he wants to. And those kinds of things are healthy.
Endearing.
They're good. And they'll be different for every couple.
Yeah.
But I don't believe in the husband must control the checkbook. The husband is responsible for the family finances.
Listen, if you're a husband like that, get a life. You know, Mary Lee always has liked to go to a quick oil change place that will vacuum her car.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can imagine that, you know, for years I was like, tried to avoid knowing about it, tried to avoid thinking about it. But she, it wasn't for the oil. And I knew she was changing oil much more frequently than it needed to be changed. She loved to get her car vacuumed.
Yeah. Well, in a lot of cases, a little bit of ignorance about how the other person spends the money.
Yeah, that's true.
Is incredibly valuable.
That's absolutely true. A little bit of ignorance about how the other person uses the toilet. And I'm serious in bringing that up. There need to be areas of our life that we are not intimate with our spouses. And it is not cowardice or irresponsibility.
Yep.
It is simply a recognition of the fact that, and so many men don't know this. They don't know it. And they think that because they're the head of the home, that means that they have to have authority over every single decision of the home. And it's just
gross.
It's just so gross. I mean, can you imagine Abigail? You know, can you imagine Priscilla and Aquila? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. In other words, imagine Abraham and Sarah. Imagine Isaac and Rebecca. She's peeling off Jacob because she likes Jacob. And he's got, now I'm not trying to argue that we should have favorites and lie to each other. That's not my point.
No.
But obviously that didn't come out of nowhere with her. She said to have that's the idol of marriages among Jews is Isaac and Rebecca.
Mm-hmm.
You know, such a beautiful marriage. And so let's be humble about what constitutes a good marriage when it comes to finances and not be
doctrinaire.
Yeah, not be doctrinaire.
When it comes to managing money, making money, spending money, giving money, there is no one-size-fits-all approach.
And let me say something else about wives. There is something connected between being a female and beauty. Now, that sounds stupid. It sounds like John Madden, you need to put... but I think we forget what it is to be man and woman today.
Mm-hmm.
I would encourage you to cultivate and encourage your wife in anything she's interested in that makes beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this might sound crazy to you, but I've had people ask me, for instance, should I keep the piano in my house? Because I don't really play it that much. And I will say to them, no, keep the piano because it creates beauty. Play your piano. And so you think of the investment of a piano. There should be a piano in the home if the wife or the husband, there should also be flowers. There should also be sewing and material.
Mm-hmm.
And I could keep going. There should be beauty in the way that cooking is done. Could encourage your wife by telling her, look, I'm not going to be doctrinaire when it comes to you spending money on what is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And so with my wife, it's like the sewing machine, the material, a huge amount of money, huge is spent on children and babies. Now, I don't mean that we buy babies. What I mean is that as of, for instance, the last couple of weeks, just today, Mary Lee was the doula for our daughter-in-law who just gave birth a few hours ago to a little boy. And then a week and a half ago, she was at, well, these doulas, she's up at 96 or 97, I think now. Time is actually money. Mary Lee, across her life, could have made us insanely rich. When we first got married and we worked together, Mary Lee's a super seamstress. And she would make, from beautiful muslin, she would make Victorian nightgowns. And she would sell them on State Street in Madison at a by-hand gallery. And she'd make them for everybody. People loved them. They were absolutely gorgeous. You know, the lace, the simple. They weren't these extravagant things. Mm-hmm. And the material was gorgeous because it wasn't white. And it wasn't colored. It was muslin. It was just beautiful. Ivory. since we were so poor, I remember saying to her lover, make more, get more orders. And I realized I was discouraging her by doing that. And so early in our marriage, I made a promise. Now, this is maybe the most important thing I'm going to say in this podcast. You, husband, are obligated to provide for your wife and your children. You are the man of the house. And it is your job to provide so that your wife can give herself to what God has given as her gift. Eve is the life giver. That's what woman is supposed to be. And she hasn't given life when she's simply birthed a child. She gives life by nursing that child, by cleaning that child, by training that child, by raising that child. And so men, you need. And so I said to my wife one day, I realized I was oppressing her with pressure for her to earn money. I said to her lover, I'm sorry. I shouldn't do that. From now on, I will never again pressure you to make money. I will celebrate your motherhood, your femininity. One time, a few years later, I put pressure on her when I was at seminary. She was working at the Talbots doing alterations. Just talk about, you know, Boston Brahmins. You know, the Talbots is ground zero of that. And I put pressure on her. She could have made a ton of money. And I repented, and I asked her forgiveness. So I want everybody to listen to this. You are a man. It is your obligation. Now, does that mean that Mary Lee didn't earn money through the years? No. For a long time, she went into our Goodwill store, and she knew which shoes she could sell through eBay, and she would buy shoes, and we had a steady income from mostly shoes. You know, I got so that—
Walking around money.
Yeah, yeah. I got so that I recognized going into Goodwill which shoes I could buy and bring home and Mary Lee would sell. Now, the thing she's doing is she's doing Airbnb. And it's steady income for us. But the deal is she has no pressure whatsoever. None. And men, that is necessary for a woman to be the mother and grandmother that she needs to be. Make sure that you, when you spend the money and time of your home, that you take joy in your wife's giving herself to beauty, whether it's children, whether it's marriages, she's a wedding host, whether it's flowers, whether it's being a doula. Give your wife the gift of her being a life giver all through her life.
I think that's a great place for us to wrap. The next episode's going to be on money in the church.
And I'm looking forward to that.
Sounds good. Thanks, Tim.
All right. Thanks, Andrew.
Out of Our Minds is brought to you by New Geneva Academy. If you are interested in training for the pastorate or eldership, visit newgenevaacademy.com for more information.